So I read this story from Matthew about forgiveness. And I said to Hal and Mark in Brooklyn last Tuesday, I'm not going to preach on forgiveness. Thank goodness Mark kind of ignored me because he picked the perfect songs for forgiveness, which was amazing. So even though the lesson is about forgiveness, sometimes if we talk about forgiveness, then it requires that we talk about the ways that we have been hurt by the world and by individuals. And that's hard and complicated. And I just did not want to preach on it. I did try to hone in a different message about the text. I do have some really good ideas about that. That was draft one. But here we are. The Spirit had other ideas about me preaching on this text about forgiveness. So I want us to focus on Matthew 18, verse 22, when Jesus answered Peter and said, I tell you, forgive not 7 times, but 77 times. Forgiving 77 times is like loving your child to the moon and back. For Jesus, the phrase, not 7, but 77 times is signaling to forgive a limitless and uncertain, nearly indescribable amount of time. And as the child said this morning, all the time. A lot of people struggle with the forgiveness of others and also themselves, and they certainly do not want to practice forgiveness 77 times. In other words, affinity. The phrase 70, not 77, not 77 is first encountered in Genesis 4:24 when Cain is avenged 7 times and then his descendant Lamech, the 7th generation from Adam, is avenged 77 times. And I'm not entirely sure of the significance of the number 7 in the ancient world, but I do know that in Genesis 2:3, God blessed the 7th day and made it holy and rested. So 7 is significant in our religious tradition. Perhaps this verse 22 is like the last part of Psalm 23. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies, and you anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows and overflows and overflows. Forgiving 77 times is like a cup that continues to overflow with an abundance of love and hope and grace. Or maybe the 77 is like the time the water turned to wine, just when the party thought the 30 gallons of wine jars at the wedding in Cana were gone. Their faith told them otherwise. Grace abounded with sweet wine 77 times. So, my friends, I am going to attempt to scratch the surface of forgiveness. What I do know is that it's almost impossible to forgive without grace. So we will start there. Diana Butler Bass, our upcoming visiting scholar on October 1st, and the book study starts today, says something like, grace is a theological term that means unmerited favor, given without the expectation of return. You offer a gift to others as God has offered us gifts and does not expect us to return the gift. There is no benefit with this kind of grace, except maybe for yourself. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a German pastor and theologian, coined the term costly grace and cheap grace. And he coined the term because he was outspoken in opposition to the Nazis. He was arrested and imprisoned and then died. The grace that was given, that he gave, was hard and indeed a cost. Cheap grace, he says, is the preaching of forgiveness without requiring repentance, baptism without church discipline, communion without confession, absolution without personal confession. Cheap grace is grace without discipleship, grace without the cross, grace without Jesus Christ living incarnate. In other words, cheap grace is being quiet in the face of suffering or staying out of the fray. Cheap grace is not engaging in the conflict, staying complacent in the face of injustice. Cheap grace is pretending that suffering does not exist because you cannot see it or feel it. Forgiveness and grace are two theological terms that go hand in hand. Forgiving will take grace, and it will be costly kind of grace. The benefit of forgiveness is really only for the one forgiving. It will mean speaking up when it is not comfortable or being vulnerable, perhaps exposing your worst fears and reliving a terrible experience. The story of your life will change as it did for the disciples when they dropped their nets and followed Jesus. That is the kind of forgiveness and grace I am talking about. It is costly. Some people would say, well, we are pacifists, and so we don't engage in conflict. We don't create conflict. Costly grace is an invitation to be with and in the suffering so that it affects change. Bonhoeffer believed that risking his life and risking discomfort and risking conflict and hardship in the face of injustice is kingdom work, Jesus work, 77 times work. This work is costly grace. It means suffering with those suffering from the systems of the world or institutional barriers. It is an important grace, the grace that forgives when it seems impossible. It is the Good Samaritan grace. You know the story of the Good Samaritan who decided to stop and help the man on the side of the road. This grace is one that gets into the ditch with the suffering on the side of that road. It is the costly grace of risking getting dirty in the ditch, smelly and covered in blood from the one that has fallen. It is costly because it takes time and effort instead of just passing like the others did or staying angry and resentful. That is easy. We must talk about grace if we are going to talk about forgiveness. It is costly, but grace is the church's inexhaustible treasury that is available to us always. And forgiveness at the simplest level is the work of the person who has suffered, and it's always a process. The invitation to forgiveness is the invitation to move away from anger and resentment to meaning-making, peace, and healing. I have a reframing personality type, like with everything. I'm almost too good at it. I often have a posture towards the prophet's job description, as I call it. So when the prophets of the Old Testament begin their work in specific communities, there are three steps. So first, they're in that community, and they're God's mouthpiece. And so God says, I want you to say this really hard thing into this community because they have this terrible behavior. They are sinning. They are not behaving right. Things are going on, and it needs to change. So I'm going to tell you what to say, and you're going to say it. So first is saying the really hard thing out loud. And then the second thing as everybody laments, including the prophet. It's sad and hard to say that really hard thing in the community. And so everybody's crying and yelling at each other and frustrating, including the prophet who had to say the thing, because everybody's really mad at the prophet for actually saying it. And so then there's this time of lament and sadness. And then the third piece is like the piece of forgiving. It is the prophet's work begins to work with the community to reimagine something new. And so you can think about it in your own lives. You say this hard thing, you name it, you say it out loud, then you grieve it, you lament it, and then you begin to reimagine a new life forward. So whether I need to forgive myself or someone else, sometimes it takes a whole lot of costly grace to do that. And it always feels hard and vulnerable and scary, because forgiving means things will change forever, and change is hard. So I want to tell you a story of personal forgiveness. About a year and a half ago, I lost a large sum of money that my father had left me. There was a small group of us that had invested in something we thought would build an alternative arts community. And we were all friends. And I was especially close to the people leading the project. And what you need to know about this large sum of money is that it was weighted down with generational trauma and abandonment. See, I watched my papa work 16 hours a day, 7 days a week, without a break, my entire childhood. Without a vacation, without family time. And I had compassion for this work ethic. He was an immigrant in America, and this is what it took. So the investment was big and heavy and weighted down with hopes of honoring his work. I wanted him to be proud. And it was something I had never done before. My friends, the ones I love, had lost it all. Gone. I won't go into the details, but all of us involved in the project were shocked and scared and angry and deeply hurt. We had been betrayed. Hundreds and thousands of dollars were gone. We had lost the dream of something beautiful. It had died. God had spoken truth that I could not hear in those first days and weeks that preceded. And so then I yelled and I lamented. I screamed at my friends with fierce tears. How could you do this? I stayed in that place for a while, and slowly then I began to reimagine. It took some time, but I told my mother what had happened, and then I told my brother, and neither of them responded with judgment or anger. And slowly I was able to talk more openly with the people that had lost the gift my father gave me. I started to process how they might have found themselves caught up in a system that is not forgiving. And I slowly started to take away the layers of shame I had put on myself. How could I do something so stupid? There was a lot of brokenness. Deep wounds were created among the entire group of investors. And so in the months after the loss, I had many conversations with a group of friends. I heard stories of what that investment meant to them. And there was also still a lot of anger. Some of the friends created divides with others. Some people were not able to talk to each other ever again. The betrayal was simply too painful. I cut ties with some of those people. And what I came to realize was that I was able to let some expectations and ideas about my father and myself die so that new growth could emerge. And while the loss is still sad and frustrating, I was able to find forgiveness for the people who led the project and then lost everything. I was able to wade into the messy waters of really uncomfortable conversations that did not fix what was broken, but rather gave me the courage to try something new and to be something new. See, what I learned is I'm actually not my papa. I am not an immigrant. I did not experience World War II in Italy and the disparity that came out of the war of his family. And I don't have to work that much to prove myself. Financial resources will not save me as they thought it would save him. I now have a different relationship to money. I don't have to continue the cycle of violence on myself or my children that he experienced. That was his story, not mine. I found new growth in this costly grace that it eventually allowed me to forgive. Forgiveness for myself and my close friends and my father, not 7 times, but 77 times. Jesus said, forgive 77 times. And he said this because the practice of forgiveness is the gateway to truly building the beloved community. The practice of forgiveness is how we relate to each other in this space, but also to the other that resides on the margins of Plymouth. Not forgiving will divide. It places barriers, anger and resentment replace one cycle of violence with another cycle of violence. So forgiving exposes the trauma, the hardships, the fight, the ugly parts of ourselves and society. But when we do that, it subverts those hardships with love. Forgiveness is Ann Thompson standing up here telling her tragic story about gun violence a few Sundays ago. Forgiveness is the testimonies of our queer church members testifying to their personal stories on Pride Sunday. The practice of forgiveness is speaking truth to power, like the prophets, even when it feels impossible. Forgiveness is telling your story even when it seems too hard. Forgiveness is allowing love to overcome anger and resentment. But let me be clear. It does not mean the hurt and betrayal get erased. Forgiveness is a practice that continues over and over again. And like any other faith practice that Jesus teaches us about, it is a lifelong endeavor 77 times over. It is an invitation to move away from anger and resentment to meaning-making, peace, and healing. When we practice forgiveness in this way, it is hard. There may be tears.